Hi, this is your Marketplace Money host, Tess Vigeland. This program was produced for the weekend of August 7th, 2009. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Riddle me this. If you get a pink slip by email, is it still pink?
I quickly posted to Twitter about the frightening email, then signed on to Instant Message to get the scoop from my colleagues. It's hitting the fan, they pinged back. You better call.
A Silicon Valley veteran talks about losing a job Web 2.0 style. And a tight job market plus a tanked stock market equals Americans saving more and spending less. But will it last?
Americans really like to consume. People will consume at the level that they think their wealth and incomes make appropriate.
Plus, being frugal has become downright trendy these days, but not everything is cheaper to make at home.
It costs more to make butter by whipping your cream than it does to buy butter. It does not make sense unless you have a cow.
Hear from a blogger who breaks down the true costs of DIY food and drink. That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. The government's home loan modification program got its first official report card this week. Mom and dad would not be pleased. As of last month, only 9% of the homeowners who were eligible for help had gotten any. Meanwhile, 1.5 million households received foreclosure notices. I'm Tess Vigla, and this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
The government has tried all kinds of ways to keep borrowers in their homes, to mixed results. Well, here's a new non-government program that may at least assist with future mortgages. It's called the Fair Mortgage Collaborative. It's nonprofit, created by housing industry insiders, and it's vowing to help change the kinds of mortgages we're offered and the way we get them. Howard Banker is the executive director, and I asked him to explain exactly how the program works.
Pretty much, it's a good housekeeping seal of approval for a lending delivery system. What we do is we say to the consumer, any lender on our list is available for you, and you should contact them. So we do not offer loans. We only provide lists of certified lending organizations that consumers can use.
So how will that work? Will you look at any loan that comes through that any consumer asks you to look at and say, yes, this works for you, and no, this doesn't?
Well, we look rigorously at the lender. So we look at the loan products that they offer, and we compare them to the rules that we've established. And our rules require that the lender act in the consumer's interest, not the other way around. The consumer must be offered the best product for which they're eligible at the best price. There are a list of products that the lender is absolutely not allowed to offer. If the lender offers those products, they can't be certified.
What are some examples of that?
One example is something which isn't used too much anymore, but will come back, and that's called a stated income loan.
The so-called liar loan is what I think we all heard it referred to.
Well, it's quite accurate. What it does is it just simply allows the consumer to say what their income is with no verification.
Right. Well, then how are you going to police that process? I mean, your organization certainly is not going to look at every single mortgage loan that is offered and granted.
Well, funny you mention that. Actually, we are. If a lending organization becomes certified, they deliver to us all the mortgage loans they make. And because nobody is perfect, certainly some loans will pop up. Well, we'll then deal with the lender and make sure that those loans were appropriate for the consumer. But yes, we will be checking all the loans made by all the lenders that we certify.
This Fair Mortgage Collaborative is made up of lenders and brokers and people who do the technology around mortgage lending. Are you concerned at all about a perception that this is the fox guarding the hen house? I mean, why trust the same folks who got us into trouble in the first place?
We have heard that said, and that's why it's important to understand the difference how we work. The folks that own the Fair Mortgage Collaborative, which in fact is a nonprofit organization, are themselves all nonprofit organizations. And so they have no financial interest in the success of the organization. Their interest is protecting consumers.
Okay, so the lenders themselves are not part of the apparatus that will be determining whether mortgages are good or not.
Correct.
Okay.
Just as Maytag doesn't own the Energy Star brand, Energy Star brand is applied to an appropriate Maytag product.
Then why not just support the Obama administration's Consumer Financial Protection Agency? I mean, what you're talking about sounds very similar to what they have proposed.
Their proposal is great, and we fully support it. And if it actually does come to pass in our lifetime, it would be a very, very powerful tool. And if it does what we do, then we absolutely will dissolve ourselves. We have no investors that we must repay.
When will these certifications be available?
They're currently available.
So you've already determined some lending organizations that meet your qualifications, and people can find out who that is on your website?
That's correct. And by the state that they live in, and pretty soon we're going to have a zip code finder so that the consumer can simply punch in their zip code and up will pop lists of lenders that they can contact.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that on our website. Howard Banker is the executive director of the Fair Mortgage Collaborative. Boy, they picked the guy with the right name to head this one up, huh?
I guess so.
Mr. Banker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story, and with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello, Tess, and what's on your mind?
Well, you know, we've just heard about this new way for folks to try to make sure that their mortgage is good for them, but, you know, it's certainly way too late for all the people who are already in foreclosure and about to go into foreclosure. These numbers just keep going up, don't they?
They do. It's stunning.
Well, I wanted to ask you a little bit about foreclosures and a study that came out recently from Professor Michael LaCour Little. He teaches at Cal State Fullerton. And he took a look at about 4,000 foreclosures here in Southern California and found that, contrary to what a lot of us have heard and believed, these foreclosures were not people who bought at the height of the market in the frenzy. These are people who bought in the 1990s, early 2000s, but who took tons of money, tons of equity out of their homes. Does this surprise you at all?
It surprises me a little bit in this sense. We've all fallen into this habit of treating the bubble and the people who are falling into foreclosures as, you know, someone who've been renting and then they saw the prices going up and finally they stretched their finances to buy, or, you know, living in a low income neighborhood and someone comes through and says, hey, I got a no doc loan here for you, and kind of fallen into that mental habit. But if we think back, this concept, this idea of treating your home like an ATM, boy, that was around, wasn't it?
Right.
I mean, the marketing and the loans, pay for your college, consolidate all your debt. But I think it's a really important reminder. And he looks at Southern California, which is one of the epicenters of foreclosure. And what's going to be fascinating is if the results show up elsewhere around the country. And my suspicion is the answer is going to be yes.
Then what about the rescue packages for people who are going into foreclosure? There has been this argument that, well, they bought at the top of a bubble. They didn't really know any better. There was a lot of fraud going on in the mortgage market. Well, but then we hear that a lot of these cases, that not so much. It was their own really bad judgment.
It was a really bad judgment, and it's the nature of a bubble. I mean, one of the aspects of a bubble is when we look back, you have to ask yourself, how could people be so stupid? How could people be so irresponsible? And yet, when you're in the bust, you end up bailing out a lot of those people. I mean, that's what we've done on Wall Street.
So you're saying really that at this point, we can't be paying attention to exactly how these people got into trouble. If we don't help them, the economy is not going to recover.
At this particular moment in time, but off of what you're saying and also your reaction test, I think it's really important. You know, there are going to be other bubbles. Mm-hmm. There are going to be other booms. The real estate market is going to revive at some point, and we're going to see some increase in value. And people are going to start thinking about, do I take out a home equity line of credit? Oh, it's cheap money. And at that point, that's when I get worried. And that's when I think your perspective is extremely important. What is your responsibility at that point not to borrow too much?
All right. And the old lesson, your home is somewhere to live, not an investment. Thanks so much, Chris. We'll talk to you later with Getting Personal.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by LendingTree, offering the ability to manage money, credit, and loans all in one place. LendingTree.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You know, it's been a terrible year when the good news is that only 247,000 jobs were lost in July. I say only in quotations. That is the latest unemployment news. The pink slips are still coming for large swaths of the workforce. But as commentator Lisa McIntyre tells us, in this recession, the pink slip isn't exactly pink or a slip.
Have pink slips gone the way of typewriters and telegrams? In my Silicon Valley bubble, getting laid off involved every Web 2.0 cliche and not a trace of colored paper. Itching for a break from the jargon-filled video conferences of my high-tech job, I went on vacation to Belgium. Determined not to let work disturb my sightseeing and beer tasting, I refused to log into my corporate email account. After a night out, I stepped in the lobby to check personal email on my smartphone using the hotel's Wi-Fi network. "Would like to have a call with you," was the subject line of a message from a director at work. Panic and fear immediately set in. My department head was not in the habit of checking in to chat. I quickly posted to Twitter about the frightening email, then signed on to instant message to get the scoop from my colleagues. "It's hitting the fan," they pinged back. "You better call." It was past midnight in Brussels. Knowing sleep was impossible, I dialed the director's phone number and got the news I had not expected in the least. I was being laid off. I had worked at the company for nearly 4 years, practically a lifetime in Silicon Valley. So this was no last in, first out. And getting the axe wasn't personal. A formula decided who got canned. An algorithm figured out how to reduce department costs. And I was the result. It never occurred to me to give my family the bad news over the phone. Letting them know through an email listserv was second nature by now. Once I was back in the States, my father advised me to get letters of recommendation on company stationery. Paper, I thought? How adorably quaint. I was busy soliciting feedback from my LinkedIn profile, reconnecting with contacts on Facebook, and commiserating with fellow layoff victims over Twitter and blogs. These days, I'm still sending out PDF copies of my cover letter and resume. I can only hope that eventually they'll result in an offer letter. On paper.
Lisa McIntyre lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. China is a nation of savers, so much so that the government sends out letters practically begging people to spend.
"We empathize with your situation. We care about you. And here's a coupon. Go out and buy a new washing machine."
And in the U.S., spending will help the economy recover, right? Don't pat yourself on the back just yet for the big restaurant bill.
"In general, a higher personal saving rate is better for the country over the long term than a lower one."
We'll hear why coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Imagine the first time your family bought a car or a fridge or a microwave. For most Americans, that was at least a generation or two ago. But in China, it's happening right now. Hundreds of millions of people are just now getting wealthy enough to buy certain appliances. And lately, the government there has been encouraging them to spend, to start shopping the way, well, the way Americans do. From Eastern China Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Shanghuang Village is 2 hours away from the glitz of modern Shanghai. Crabbing underpins this village economy. Catch them in the river, throw out the dead ones, and sell the rest in the big city. So what do these river folk do with all the money they make? They buy appliances, with a little help from Beijing. 45-year-old Ye Fengxiang was watching TV when she heard about a new government program called Appliances Go to the Countryside. It's a rebate program.
So I went out and got a new washing machine that qualified for the rebate. Before the rebate, it cost $250. Now it's only $220.
Ms. Ye already had a washer, but it was a Stone Age contraption, even by Chinese norms. It washed, it rinsed, but it didn't spin, so she had to do the rest by hand. Ye went over to the appliance store in town and looked for her replacement. In her pocket, the equivalent of $500 cash. That's a full month's income for her. The shopping trip was fast. There was no choosing.
They said this model is the only one that qualifies for the rebate, and we only have a few in stock, so you better buy it now.
Sound familiar? So don't delay, act now, supplies will run. Buy it now is Beijing's message, as the government strives to juice China's economy. One official says shopping is patriotic, and an op-ed in a state-run newspaper proclaims consumption is necessary under Marxist theory. An ideology might be a flexible tool, but this campaign is firmly fixed on rural shoppers.
The main reason is that's where all the people are.
That's Andy Rothman of the investment firm CLSA.
You'd still have a largely rural population here, about 800 million peasants, to use the Chinese government's terminology. So it's a lot of people, even if you can get a few of them to buy a couple of more refrigerators, that could have an impact.
Indeed, monthly appliance sales have tripled here in the last 4 months. Rothman thinks another benefit of this program is to boost public confidence as China's economy wobbles. Tens of millions of Chinese migrant workers from the countryside have lost their jobs.
A lot of this is to do with psychology. It's the Chinese Communist Party saying to people in the countryside, we empathize with your situation, we care about you, and here's a coupon. Go out and buy a new washing machine.
In the long run, China hopes this rebate program helps create a more consumption-based economy. Right now, this economy leans heavily on government spending and exports. But here's the rub. The average Chinese consumer is a tight wad. He or she saves 20% of each paycheck, compared to just 7% in the States. And there's good reason to save here, says economist Frank Sung. He teaches at Hong Kong University.
In China, people say it's very expensive to get sick. You probably lose all of your wealth overnight. So you have to save for the future.
But some are splurging. Back in Shanghuang Village, Ye Fengxiang's new washing machine is en route. The delivery man, Mr. Lin, loads it onto a curious three-wheel vehicle. It's a motorcycle on the front, flatbed storage area on the back.
I make a dollar for each appliance I deliver, and for a large washing machine, I make $1.50.
He gets to Ms. Ye's house, and then drags her washing machine off the flatbed and carries it in on his back. That's when Ye Fengxiang starts praising the Chinese government's rebate program, how it's good for the people. And then her talk turns to the next goodies on her list. She's going to buy an air conditioner, and then a TV. In Shanghuang Village, eastern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace Money.
We Americans are a long way from the Chinese when it comes to saving. For a while there, a couple years back, our savings rate actually went negative. As the financial crisis hit last year, we suddenly got religion and set aside a whopping 0.02%. First quarter of this year, it jumped to more than 4%. The savings rate is now the highest it's been since 1998, when Robert Shapiro was Undersecretary of Commerce for the Clinton administration. He's now chairman of the economic advisory firm Sonicon. I asked whether he thinks the savings trend will stick.
And nothing lasts forever in economics, as we found out of the recent crisis.
Right.
When behavior changes in this way, economists have no way of saying whether it's temporary or long-term. Americans have lost an enormous amount of wealth in the value of their homes, in the value of their stock portfolios, their pension plans. And for many people, that wealth was what they planned to use to retire on or to send their kids to college. They still know they're going to retire eventually. Their kids are still going to have to go to college. So they have to make that up. And the way to make it up is to save more. On the other hand, and you know, economists always have two heads.
If not three.
If not three. Americans really like to consume. People will consume at the level that they think their wealth and incomes make appropriate. So that's on the other side of it. My own guess is that the drive to restore a sense of security about retirement and college expenses will hold sway for a couple years anyway.
If we start looking more like the China that Scott Tong just described for us, what does our nation look like if we start to save more?
Let's keep in mind that, you know, the Chinese have a saving rate of 30-35%, and we're talking here about a saving rate going from 0 to 5 to 8%.
Right.
We're still talking about things on the margin here.
Mm-hmm.
Consumption is 70% of GDP. So we're bringing it down by 3.5%, that is 0.7 times 0.05. We can make that up. Either we would have a little more exports or we're going to have considerably less imports. When consumption goes down a little, you consume less of everything, including imports. The economy is indifferent to where the demand is coming from. They don't care whether it comes from, you know, a Frenchman buying something we produced or an American buying it or the government buying it.
What then would you say is the message for American consumers slash savers?
Right.
We've gone through this tough period of time where everybody kind of panicked and said, oh, my God, I got to save all my money.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you don't spend the money, the economy is going to keep dragging its heels.
Well, if you think you need to save because you want to send your kids to college or you want to retire or because you want to buy a car or for whatever purpose it is, save. In general, a higher personal saving rate is better for the country over the long term than a lower one. It means that we can provide our own capital for business investment, and that means that the profits from that business investment stay in the United States. It's also better for the whole world if we have a higher saving rate and our demand for other people's exports is less. That will force other countries to stimulate their own consumption. That's a more balanced global economy. It's a better personal economy for individuals.
All right, people, you just heard it. You can have it both ways. So go ahead and pay down your debt and start saving. Robert Shapiro, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Tess.
Part of the reason we're not saving is because it's, frankly, not that easy. And that goes double when you earn so little money that there's barely enough for the essentials. Last year, New York City started a program to encourage low-income residents to save. And guess what? It's working. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports on the first anniversary of Save NYC.
The program is aimed at New Yorkers like Carmen Lopez. She has a full-time job as a home health aide taking care of an older woman in Brooklyn. And she took time out of her lunch break to talk to me. You do the math and you realize she doesn't have anything extra.
Since they take our taxes out, I bring home, I think, is $260 a week. It's not a lot.
No, it's just over $1,000 a month. You take out $633 for the rent, plus the electric bill, cable, and, well, you get the idea. She knows she should have a little cushion.
You know, the light bill is not going to wait for you to get a paycheck. They're going to cut you off if they don't wait.
So she was excited when the city offered to pay her 50 cents for every dollar she put into a savings account. That's the point, to see if people like Lopez can be convinced to save, even if there's nothing to spare. This is how it works. The city got banks to set up special savings accounts. Low-income New Yorkers were encouraged to deposit some or all of their income tax refunds, and the city pays up to $250 in matching funds. For a lot of the participants, this was their first bank account. Jonathan Mintz is in charge of the Department of Consumer Affairs, the office that oversees the program.
When given the right opportunity and given a safe product, even those with very low incomes can and will save money.
Different cities have been trying all kinds of incentives, so everything from setting up automatic deductions from paychecks to sending text messages to remind people to save. New York already expanded the program once, and Mintz, the commissioner, says he'd eventually like to see it tried on a national scale. There are obviously questions about how cost-effective these programs are, so how much people are saving versus how much it costs to get them to save. And it seems like nobody's sure yet what works or for how long. Plus, let's be realistic here. Saving a couple of hundred dollars a year isn't going to make anybody rich. but it can make a big difference in somebody's life. Peter Tufano is a professor at Harvard Business School, and he says it can mean having enough money to fix your car when it breaks down.
Fixing your car may seem like a trivial thing to do. If by failing to fix your car, you lose your job, the economic ramifications of it are pretty big.
As for Lopez, she put $500 into the account. With the matching funds and interest, she'll get an extra $260, and she plans to do it again next year. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding, online at finrafoundation.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we answer your questions. And our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is back with us once again. And Chris, what kind of mess did the Treasury Department step into with this Cash for Clunkers program?
That's a long story, but let's just put it this way. Americans like a deal, and they like their cars.
They certainly do. And it looks like we've finally gotten enough funding so that people can go ahead and go out and use this program again without worrying that it's not going to work. And so we're going to deal with a couple of questions on this week's show. And Kim is with us from Wilmington, Vermont. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
So what's your question today?
Well, my question has to do with cars, and my husband and I are debating our best financial move regarding buying a new car.
All right.
We live in the mountains. So we get a lot of snow, and we'd like to have at least one all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive car.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a 99 Jeep Cherokee with 100,000 miles. They're both running well. Regular maintenance we've kept up with. And we've been thinking about buying a Subaru when the time comes. So our question is it better to wait until one of these cars dies and then buy a used Subaru? Or should we be trying to get in on these current incentives with the cash for clunkers or the low financing to make a better financial move?
Well, Chris, perhaps I should change your name to Tom or Ray Maliazzi.
Yeah.
Is this a question for you or for the car guys? I'm not sure.
I just can't do that accent, though. I come out sounding like some sort of version of between a Vermonter and someone from Chicago. It just doesn't quite work.
So what do you think? I mean, a lot of people writing in actually wondering about this Cash for Clunkers program, if it's a good time to go ahead and head to the car lot. What do you think for Kim?
Actually, while you were talking, I just typed in one or two things into Edmunds.com that has the has a calculator. So, you know, it says yours gets 16 miles to the gallon, and
right.
The trade-in value is around, you know, 2,600 plus change. So, mm-hmm. In that sense, you come out ahead financially. If the trade-in value is less than the $3,500 or $4,500, that leans you toward making the trade. If the trade-in value is more, obviously you don't do it.
Exactly. And I'm assuming that car prices are only going to go up and they're going to have less deals.
Yeah, it certainly is the time to buy a car if you decide that that's what's good for you. But Chris, what do you think about this notion of just driving these cars into the ground before buying a new one?
Well, I'm a big fan of that. That's what I tend to do with mine. So it's 5 years old, and I figure it's got another 5 years to go. I think it's the most cost-efficient thing to do. But, you know, there are a couple things going on here. One is just taking advantage of the deals. So, you know, my feeling, Kim, is because you have good finances, you don't have a lot of debt. You do have a car where you can trade it in and come out ahead. To me, what it really would boil down to is a question of driving to the ground or deciding to go and really buy a car that's fuel efficient. I wouldn't go for something in between.
So what do you think, Kim?
Well, I'm going to talk to my husband, see what he thinks.
Okay.
But it
fair
helps
enough.
A lot. We needed a third party to help give us some information here.
Okay. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Chris, we have another audio issue here. Alex is on the phone in San Diego, California. Alex, what's your question today?
Hi. Well, actually, I just purchased a new car through the Cash for Clunkers program the other day on Saturday.
Ah, what did you get?
New Prius.
Excellent. Are you having fun driving it so far?
a lot of fun. It's fun to see how the gas mileage is. And I've always had used cars that are at least 10 years old. And I had a 97 Mitsubishi Montero, and it was starting to have problems with the engine, and white smoke would come out, and people were reporting me to the smog hotline every once in a while. And the Cash for Clunkers program just came along at exactly the right time for me.
All right. Well, Chris, this is feeling more and more like the Car Talk program. But Alex, let's go ahead and ask you what your question is.
Well, my question was, since I've never really had a car payment, what would you suggest is the best way to pay off the car as quickly as possible? And also, I recently purchased a house last year. Would it make sense for me to try to put part of the car loan on the home loan?
No. I think the answer there is going to be no.
The answer is going to be no. But the reason why is this is how a lot of people during the boom did get themselves in trouble. You put all your debt in your homes, and then when people got into trouble, there was no safety valve. All of a sudden, your home was at risk to foreclosure. Whereas if you have your credit card debt, you know, you can say to the credit card company, I'm sorry. I mean, the auto loan, you know, at worst, they repossess your car, but they can't repossess your house.
Okay.
So that's why I don't like it. I can tell you what I did. I paid off my car loan. But when I did take out my car loan, it was a three-year car loan and had a minimum payment. I can't remember what it was. I think it was, say it was $250. And what I did is just sort of played around with the numbers and came up with a number. I think I put in like $330 a month. Come up with a number above the minimum. And if you have a bad month, you can always go back to the minimum. And if you have a good month, you can always, you know, put some more in there.
Great. Yeah.
So is that something you have room for in your budget?
Hopefully. You know, with the home, it's a 1912 Craftsman house that needs a lot of repairs. So it's kind of a balance between working on home repairs and paying off the car sooner. So I was just trying to see if there was some tricks that I didn't know about. And it sounds like I'll just try to keep paying more than the minimum each month.
That's right.
All right. Thanks for the call, Alex.
Well, I love your show. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Well, if your financial life is a clunker, we do not have cash for you, but we do have Chris. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can write us an email. Just use the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we will be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. When your car is in a wreck, you just want it fixed ASAP. But be sure to read the fine print at the mechanic.
They come up with all these different terms, and they're basically junkyard parts.
And if you miss our show because you're checking on your car at the shop, you can always podcast us and listen anytime. Just subscribe at marketplace.org. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Earlier in the show, we talked, as we often do these days, about how more of us are tightening our belts. We're speaking financially, of course, but hopefully we're all in the habit of tightening another belt, the ones in our cars. Aside from the obvious danger issues, accidents can be a source of great financial frustration. Cash Peters learned that lesson recently and decided to share his experience.
So here's the story. I was doing a report for this show, actually, about the benefits of leasing my car, when the whole story changed, because, somewhat ironically, I crashed it.
Wow, that's significant.
You're not kidding. Some freak rammed into me on the freeway. $18,000 worth of damage and 10 weeks in the shop. Nobody was hurt, luckily. And by nobody, I mean me. I have no clue about the other guy. But it's my first accident, and quite honestly, I didn't know what to do next. Avo Denoyen is my agent at Allstate Insurance.
You get all the facts, you write them down, exchange information, take photos, then call our claims department. They're professionally trained to answer all the questions.
Okay, so that's what I did. However, and here's the thing, without even meaning to, I did three very smart things after the accident that really made a difference. First, I had a video camera with me, so I filmed everything, including the guy admitting that it was his fault. Now, apparently, Avo doesn't approve of that, because who knows, the guy might get violent.
You did what you did at the spur of the moment. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't recommend to do it. The more information, the better. But I don't want to have a camera and direct the camera on somebody's face and record his statement. I wouldn't do that.
All right, so let me qualify this. It's not advisable, maybe, but it was smart in my particular situation because later on, when the other guy's insurance company got fresh and tried to pin the blame on me, guess what? I produced his video confession. Proof! Damn, they said, and paid up. Next, though, I had to get the car fixed, so naturally I called my insurance company.
When you call that 1-800 number, they would recommend a preferred body shop. Their workmanship is guaranteed for as long as you have the car. So you have no worries.
Yeah, now steady on there, cowboy. I decided to worry a whole lot, as a matter of fact. The second smart thing I did was ask a ton of difficult questions, such as, what if I don't like the body shop they recommend? What then? Can I pick one of my own? The answer is yes, you can. You choose which shop to use. Go to the wrong place, and you could end up with anything under your hood. Lawnmower, parts, garden hose, bits of someone else's car. Steve Lossoff runs repair shop DC Autograft.
Oh, absolutely. They're constantly looking at ways to cut cost. Crash parts and aftermarket parts and used parts, which they dress up using like, kind, and quality. They come up with all these different terms, and they're basically junkyard parts.
Am I not protected? I mean, isn't somebody looking over these guys' shoulders and saying, you're putting garden hose in that?
Not really. We're not regulated.
Oh, yike. Is that right? Someone might want to look into that. Because the quality of the work is really important. Mike Bradford's an Audi dealer in Pasadena.
I've been in this business a long time, and I've seen crash test footage of cars that have been repaired with parts that weren't original equipment parts. And it's a nightmare. I've seen hoods rip off of their hinges and come projecting into the driver's area right through the windshield. Obviously, they're not designed to do that.
No, you think? The whole thing's a minefield. Anyway, the body shop I was sent to was certified, so they were good. But you know what? I got a bad vibe from them. Call me psychic. So, and here, finally, is the third smart thing I did. I stood my ground, resisted all the pressure, and chose instead to go to DC Autograft. They're like the Boeing of vehicle repair. Expensive, so it's not good news for the guy who hit me or his insurance company, but at least I know my car will be okay. Steve Lossoff again.
It's buyer beware, and the first most important thing for a layman is to go look at the shop. Just look at some of the work that they've done. They have to be able to show you that they're qualified to do these repairs a little bit more than just a sign that's posted on their window saying factory trained.
One of the things you noted was, hey, I had this tremendous accident and I was safe. If you repaired that car with substandard parts or improper procedures, the car might not be in the condition to do that for you the next time. That's very important.
Yeah, but who do I trust? Because all these people were lovely.
Well, I would submit that by going to the dealer and the factory authorized and certified body shop, you know that the manufacturer has signed off on those procedures, parts, training, etc. And that's about the best you could ask for. The consumer needs to be curious, wary, and ask tough questions.
I'm good, aren't I, is what you say.
I think in this instance you did a great job.
So what can I say? Hooray for me, really. In Pasadena, California, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace Money.
Cash Peters is a humorist whose latest book is Naked in Dangerous Places. Just hopefully not in his car. We are back with more Getting Personal, and I'm here with Chris Farrell, our economics editor. And Chris, we've got more people with more questions. Aurora is in Los Angeles. Hi, Aurora.
Hi.
What's your question for us today?
I'm trying to figure out how to invest for my retirement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a really socially responsible buyer.
Mm-hmm.
I buy organic and local whenever I can. I try to support small businesses. At my old job, I had a 403B, and I could invest in a socially responsible fund. And at my new job, they don't have that option.
Okay. A couple things. Is there a match in this plan?
There is. It's 3%.
Okay. The match is part of your compensation, and that's where almost all the investment kit comes from.
Right.
You don't have to put the money into equities. You don't have to put the money into companies. If you're comfortable investing in a money market mutual fund or perhaps there's some sort of bond fund, short-term bond fund, you know, take a look at the offerings and which one really doesn't bother you.
Okay.
And I'm taking that seriously when I say doesn't bother you. And put the money into that.
Okay.
And then take advantage of the match.
Okay.
And then if she would want to do some socially responsible investing elsewhere.
Which is what I do want to do with a greater percent of my take-home pay.
You know, perhaps if you haven't opened up a Roth IRA, and with a Roth IRA, you're putting the money in, it's after tax dollars.
Right, okay.
And, you know, there's some really broad-based, good, socially responsible equity index funds. There's also a very good website called socialinvest.org.
Okay.
And it's, I'd say it's probably the leading portal into the socially responsible investing universe.
Okay. Okay, cool. Well, I will call my HR and talk to them about what options I have for my 3% match, and then I will look into that website.
Terrific. Well, thanks for the call, Aurora.
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much for your help.
And Chris, let's go to our next caller. Kristen is on the line from your neck of the woods, Minneapolis. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
How can we help you out today?
I'm calling because I am starting a new job in about a month.
That's quite a feat in this economy.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. So I'm getting ready to start it, and it's a two-year position. So I'm categorized as a temporary employee, and I'm not able to contribute to their workplace retirement plan.
Oh, okay. Another question about retirement accounts.
Yeah. If I'm going to shoot for that 10 to 15% benchmark for contributing to retirement savings, the Roth isn't going to quite cut it.
Yeah, you know, Chris, this is a great question. Why Congress places these limits on our retirement savings? And you've never really had an answer for me, but...
it's insane. Why do we still have a 403B, a 401K, a 457, a Roth 401K, a SEP IRA? And the rules are slightly different. How much you can put aside is slightly different. Now explain that one to me.
Yeah, so what are her options?
Well, you want to invest in a CFRSP.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry. Say that again.
CFRSP. It is the Chris Farrell Retirement Savings Plan.
Oh, this is a new one. Very good.
Now,
where I just send you money in an envelope every month.
Hey, I hadn't thought about that one. No, so it's composed of two elements. The first is I-bonds. Which okay. You can buy a maximum of $10,000 a year. The money compounds tax deferred, just like it would if you could participate in your 401k or 403b.
Okay. How do I buy those? Is it just the government website or?
Yep. Just go to the U.S. Treasury website.
Okay.
ustreasury.gov.
Okay.
And you can buy $5,000 online, and then you can just go to your bank and you can buy $5,000 in paper.
Okay.
The other part of it is that you buy broad-based equity index fund, Standard & Poor's 500, Russell 3000. There's a little bit of a tax obligation every year, but not that much.
So, Kristen, what do you think about the
CFRSP.
CFRSP.
You got to give me your address so I know where to send the cash every month. I think that sounds definitely feasible. I mean, I guess what I was hoping to hear was, no, there's this secret retirement account that people don't usually talk about. I've never made any investments outside of retirement accounts. So I guess it's just sort of a psychological leap.
Yeah. Now, there is something else you can do.
Is this the secret plan?
This is not quite the secret plan, but this is what I do. You have $25, $50, $100, whatever you've decided, taken automatically out of your checking account or your savings account every month that goes into the fund. I mean, you can use technology to at least replicate part of what you just mentioned is the real attractiveness of a 403B or a 401K, which is that it just happens.
Yeah, that is the part that I really like about it. I mean, it never hits my account, and so I don't ever feel like I made that money to start with, so I don't miss it.
Well, just set it up so you have your own super secret retirement account.
Sounds like a plan. I think I can do that. Thanks for taking my question.
You bet.
Bye.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for Getting Personal this week, but you can leave your question with us anytime. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or write to us. You can do that through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org, where you will also find Chris's blog. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Des.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I've talked before about how frugal chic has taken hold of this nation. Seems you're a better person these days if you make your own clothes and cobble the soles of your own shoes. Well, we are all about money and savings on this show, but we wonder just how much you actually save with DIY everything. Well, Jennifer Reese has done some of the math. The former book reviewer for Entertainment Weekly lost her job a few months ago. Now she's a blogger channeling Betty Crocker and trying to determine what that does to her bottom line. I drove to Reese's home just north of the Golden Gate Bridge, and the smell of yeast wafted through the air before I even reached the door.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Tess.
Oh, hi, you're with Zoe. I was
reading over my
suit. Nice to meet you. You too.
These days, Reese is a backyard apiarist who also raises chickens and makes all kind of food and drink from scratch.
Well, do you have anything homemade?
No.
No? No homemade root beer or whiskey or anything like that?
No. Oh, actually, I do.
She offered me some Cherry Bounce, a concoction of cherries and bourbon that's been stewing in the pantry for months. Perhaps this is why she calls herself the Tipsy Baker. We chose to stick with water for the afternoon refreshment, and Reese got started punching holes in blobs of dough on the kitchen counter.
Look at these. These are big, gnarly bagels. They're sort of beautiful in their rough way.
They look homemade.
They look homemade.
As she plopped them into boiling water, Reese noted that when she started doing all this happy homemaker stuff, she wasn't sure about its cost effectiveness. So she checked what a single bagel from the grocery would cost. 45 cents. At the national bagel chain Noah's, 75 cents. Here in Tipsy Bakerland, a winning 15 cents a bagel. But not every frugal food effort is paying off so promptly. We headed out back to what we'll call Reese's Urban Livestock Center.
Hey girls, where are you? Come here. Come here. See, we have 12 chickens. They were about $3 each to buy. And they have been incredibly cheap.
And what have they given to you?
Nothing yet, but they are going to start producing eggs, I'm sure, like, you know, 60 eggs a week, I'm hoping. The cost effectiveness, we're going to about break even in terms of how much I've spent on the chickens, if they produce anything like what they're supposed to produce. But we're going to have so many more eggs than we need that if we could actually sell them, we would make a profit.
So far, the chickens cost about $175. We walked through her new veggie and fruit gardens and back upstairs to the kitchen. The now baked and browned bagels came out of a hot oven.
See, you would never mistake these for a store-bought.
No, I wouldn't, but I kind of like
Some of them don't even really have a hole.
Now, do you have any homemade cream cheese to go with these?
I made cream cheese, and that was not a success. It was very loose, creamy, and it just was not something anybody really wanted to eat.
And it didn't come in a block surrounded by foil.
Exactly.
So, no more homemade cream cheese. I wondered what else she'd attempted where the cost-benefit analysis didn't exactly work in her favor.
I made butter. That was really stupid. It costs more to make butter by whipping your cream than it does to buy butter. It does not make sense unless you have a cow.
Jam, however, is cost-competitive. Crackers are not. Granola isn't either, but she says it tastes so much better that it's worth the extra cost of making your own. There was, however, one bit of frugal fooding for which Reese may never recoup her investment.
Would you like to see the bees?
Oh, yes.
We walked out to a small deck with 2 3-foot-tall apiaries. I asked what had prompted her to become a suburban San Francisco beekeeper.
Well, I don't know. I had always thought about doing all these things, and I lost my job in December. And suddenly I had a lot of time, and I started thinking about my little piece of land and what I could do.
And that naturally led her to a beekeeping seminar.
It's an extremely expensive hobby.
What was your initial investment here?
I have spent $1,000.
$1,000?
2 beehives with the bees and the books and the smokers. And that is not, I mean, I was not extravagant.
All right, well then let's ask what you've gotten for your investment?
Nothing.
Nothing? Yet?
Nothing yet. Conceivably, if these hives produce what beehives can produce average in the San Francisco Bay Area, you could get about $350 a year, but I would have to sell the honey and bottle it. And that is.
And are you planning to do that?
No.
No?
But who knows?
But really, she said, as we returned to the kitchen, efforts like these can't just be about pinching pennies. Reese says when she first started tabulating her costs,
I assumed that it was ridiculous and that it was going to be, of course it was going to be cheaper to buy your own yogurt. I thought everything everyone did in a factory was going to be cheaper. And it was sort of this fake economy around being crunchy and homespun. But it actually turns out to be almost true. that you can save money by doing things at home.
So how much of this is to save money?
None.
And how much of it is something else?
I don't know if I think it's about that. The chicken coops and the bees are about frugality. I think that if you say that you're doing it to be frugal, that's probably not rational.
And with that, it was finally time to partake of the Tipsy Baker's bagels.
Well, I think they're tasty.
They're tasty.
And they actually have a little more crunch on the outside than normal bagels do, and I like that. Mm-hmm. So how often do you make these?
I've made these maybe 6 or 7 times. My kids love them. I made the first batch I made, they ate them all in like an hour.
All right, well, we're going to put up this recipe on our website and invite folks to make bagels right along with you and see how that process goes. Jennifer, thanks so much for inviting me into your home and feeding me.
Oh, thank you.
That was Jennifer Reese, also known as the Tipsy Baker. Check out our website for a veritable buffet of photos and recipes. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, an elderly couple struggles to avoid foreclosure on the home they love.
Such a joy to wake up in the morning and come into a nice, bright living room. I never get used to it. It doesn't get boring.
We'll hear from seniors hit hard by the housing crisis. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Trobe. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com.
American Public Media.